we go and we recite the 10 plagues.
I did not watch that, so you don't have to say that. Okay, thank you. Welcome, Yaakov. What do we do when we recite the 10 plagues at the Seder? I'm sure, I'm willing to bet every single person here, without exception, has this custom. Correct me, whether you're Ashkenazic, whether you're Sephardic, whether you're Hasidic, whether you're a Yeki, whether you're a Glutziata, doesn't matter where you are, where you're from, who you are. What do? We all dip. We take that, you know, we take our pinky and we dip it in the wine and we shake off one drop of wine. We do that 10 times. And why do we do that? What's the point?
We don't rejoice when others...
Because we're mindful of the fact that, you know, Hashem found it necessary to save the Jewish people by taking the lives away of these people who were evil people. They deserved what we got. But we still, you know, let's not forget about the fact that we spill out one drop of wine, but we drink the rest of the cup. You know what I'm saying? Like we are rejoicing and we are celebrating, but in the midst of our celebration, we're pausing for a moment to reflect upon the fact that these human beings, they had to perish. What a contrast between this custom and the wild celebrations that occurred yesterday by the Palestinians. They were dancing in the streets celebrating the death of these innocent Jews in Yerushalayim. They were handing out candy. They were so excited. We see their depravity. We see how evil these people are. I think it's very important that, by the way, it's good to think about this every single day. When we recite the prayer Oleinu, we begin by saying, you know, we say Oleinu L'Shabeach. It's our duty to praise you, God, for placing us, we have the privilege of, you brought us into this world as part of the Jewish nation. That's a zechus. That's something we can't fully express our gratitude to the extent that we need to. So when we look at the contrast, but we see what these people are like. We see what our enemies are like. And we look at the attitude that we have day and night. These are different creatures. So, of course, there's a tremendous sense of fear. I right after this occurred, I called up my cousin, a woman who lives in the neighborhood where the terrorist incident took place in Harnof. I called up a very wonderful woman. Her name is June, and I got on the phone with her and I said, June, I said, I don't have anything to say to you, but I just had to talk to you. And I asked her the following. You know, we schmoozed for a while. I said, I'm going to be talking to people here about what occurred. Is there anything that you would like me to give over in your name? And she said, there's only one thing I would like to ask for you to convey to whoever you speak to. Ask everyone to daven for the refuah shleima, for the healing of those who were wounded. So I would like to ask all of you to have in mind the following 5 individuals. I'm going to hand this sheet out. Psalm number 121, authored by David HaMelech, by King David. Shmuel ben Bela, Chaim Yechiel ben Malka, Eitan ben Tzor, Yitzchok ben Chaya, Moshe ben Atorah. By the way, I don't know if you know this, but I think it's worth mentioning, in case sometimes people are wondering how did these terrorists, how was it that they were able to do their thing? Like no one stopped them. They were just they just walked in. There were 30, 40 Jews there, and they just went around butchering people. How did that happen? So I don't know if you know this, but one of the terrorists was a worker in the synagogue. He was a worker in the synagogue. He was one of the caretakers. And the second terrorist worked in a grocery store right nearby in a Makolot, you know, if you've been to Israel. He worked at a grocery store and stocking stuff or whatever he was doing over there. So when the people in the shul who were regulars, when they saw these two Arabs, nobody gave it a second thought. So, okay. I'm going to read one pasuk, one verse at a time. And you can, you know, repeat after me. You can read it in Hebrew, you can read it in English, as you prefer. Okay, please rise. Shila malo, seso enai elehore, meyayin yavo esri. Ezri meyim Adonai osei shumayim v'boretz.
Ezri meyim Adonai osei shumayim v'boretz.
Al yitein lamod raglecho v'al yonum shomrecho. Hinei lo yonum v'lo yishon shomer Yisrael. Adonai Shomrecho, Adonai Tzilcho, Al Yad Yeminecho. Yomo Mashemesh Lo Yakeko Ve'yorayach Baloilo. Adonai Yishmocho Mikoro, Yishmo Es Nafshecho. Adonai Yishmot Seisecho Uvovecho Miyato V'yad Olohom. You may be seated. Tonight's lecture is a memorial lecture, the Mark and Kushikow family's memorial lecture. Their children, many, many years ago, they arranged with Jeb that we should have an annual lecture in memorial of their parents, Eugene Mark, who was involved in making this arrangement with his wife, Oliver Sholem. He's no longer with us. Actually, you know, there's certain things that happen in Jeb, certain people who play a role, and you haven't even met the people. Gertrude and Eugene Mark are a very good example of that. Gertrude and Eugene Mark, they donated to Jeb the only Sefer Torah, the only Torah that we have in our possession. And when they donated this Torah back in, I think, 1991, we had a parade on Boston Post Road. Some of you were there. With 200 people. Can you imagine 200 people walking down Boston Post Road accompanied by music, carrying a Torah? That was like, you know, with police escorts, the whole nine yards. It was unbelievable. In any event, so, you know, they set up this memorial lecture in memory of their parents. I'd like to say that of our being here tonight, we hope will elevate the departed neshamos of the parents of Eugene and Gertrude Mark. Yeah. Oh yes, I'm very glad you mentioned that. My trusty wife, who's my memory bank, she reminded me of the fact that we should have in mind in our prayers Gertrude Mark, who I mentioned. She is currently very ill. Her name is Gittel Bashenu, and she needs a refuah shleima, and we hope and pray that she will be well. Tonight, it is my great privilege to reintroduce, because we've had the pleasure of hearing Rabbi Vitters before. Rabbi Jared Vitters from the community of Muncie is with us this evening. Actually, you can get an idea of who this guy is by noticing that there are a couple of people here who are here because they got the word Rabbi Vitters is coming. So, Rabbi Vitters is some of you here got to meet Rabbi Vitters the first time about a year and a half ago when we spent an entire weekend on the campus of Yeshiva Or Sameach up in Muncie. We had a spectacular Shabbaton, and Rabbi Vitters was one of the featured lecturers, and he really wowed and dazzled the crowd. Like, it was like, you know, it was superb. And, you know, when he, you know, at the end of the weekend, when I said goodbye to Rabbi Vitters, I said, Rabbi Vitters, we're going to bring you up to Westchester. We got to have you up. And we had him already. He's given a lecture up here, and now he's back tonight. Rabbi Vitters is a practicing attorney in general practice. And in addition, he's involved in Jewish education. He speaks to all sorts of diverse crowds. He speaks in high schools. He speaks in different communities in the metropolitan area. And in just a couple of minutes, you're going to discover why he is such a sought-after individual. I consider Rabbi Vitters to be a dear personal friend, and he's going to be talking on a very, very important topic, the subject of maintaining one's values in a world of political correctness. You know, we live in a world where it occurred to me tonight when I was coming here that you have to be so politically correct in this world that if you tell someone that you're going tonight to listen to a Torah class, that's politically incorrect. But we're here. You know, okay, Rabbi Vitters, please.
George Bernard Shaw sent a letter to Winston Churchill, and he said, I'm including two tickets to my play that's opening. So there's one for you, and bring a friend if you have one. So Winston Churchill wrote back, said, I can't make it the first night. Maybe you send me tickets for the second night, if you have one. So I'm fortunate that it's our second opportunity back to lecture here by Jep, the second opportunity. So I want to thank, obviously, to Jep and to the Mark and the Kushikow families and to our hosts, the Newmans. Thank you very, very much for opening your home. I think I want to thank Rabbi Zaitchek, but I'm not sure. Time will tell. Last year we spoke about Tu B'Shvat. So, you know, the birthday of the trees is a lot less complicated than political correctness. I mean, everyone's for trees. Right? No one's against, I mean, most people, right? But anyway, PC is a little more of a delicate topic, but, you know, my mom always told me that, you know, you never really want to talk about politics and religion. So when I told her I'm going to, you know, give a Jep shiur on political correctness, you know, well, she said, maybe you want to think twice. But anyway, I'm glad I'm here, and we have a ton to accomplish tonight. So here's the ground rules. We're going to speak for about 45 minutes. Those of you who know me know that I'll set my watch so we won't go overboard. Okay? And, also, if anyone has any questions, if I use any terms during the course of while I'm here, I want you to speak up and say, I don't know what you're talking about. Okay, you guys remember the story with the guy who was speaking Hebrew. I don't know if some of you were here last time, may have told the story. The guy comes in, he's speaking Hebrew to me on and on and on and on and on about Hebrew. And I wasn't really sure what he was talking about. I thought he was asking me, was I, you know, a supporter of a certain agricultural movement in Israel? And finally, I had to fess up to him. I said, no, I don't really know what you're talking about. He said, I want to know you root for the Boston Red Sox or not. So I was a little bit off. So the point is if you don't know what I'm talking about, just say, hey, I don't know what you're talking about, okay? And this is a shiur, this is a class. This is not a lecture, and it is if you have questions, comments, rebuttal, please by all means counsel if you want to object, you know, make yourself right at home. Okay, now this is what I don't want to do. I don't want to get up here and say, like, you know, society's terrible, and, like, let's just all, like, grow long payas, and otherwise, if we don't, like, we may end up on ISIS, or we may end up, like, you know, heroin addicts. Like, I don't want to do that. That's, like, I'm not in these classes. You know, imagine a guy gets engaged, and he's in his engagement party, and he says, you know, there are all these, you know, all the women out there, you know, they really, you know, lousy cooks, and they don't really know how to maintain a house, and they really, you know, wardrobe needs a lot of work, and he goes on and on and on, like, you know, slamming every other woman on the planet, and he sits down and says, you know, well, you know, you didn't say anything nice about the woman you just got engaged to. It's like, oh, right, good point. Like, all he's busy with just slamming everyone else out there. So I don't want to slam everyone else out there. I don't want to slam the rest of the world. And then, well, Judaism will be the last man standing and say, well, by default, let's be there. That's not the point. The point is to point out certain currents about what it means to live in a political correct world and how it can really undermine what we're here to accomplish as human beings and what we're here to accomplish as Jews. Okay, some of it's more overt, some of it's more covert, but that's the idea. I have one premise that I have to kind of let you know from the get-go is as follows, is that my premise is that, it's not just comes from me, is that we're in the world to perfect ourselves. In the world to become perfect people, perfect human beings. That's a tall order. Some of us have further to go than others, right? But in the meantime, if you don't understand, if a person doesn't understand, well, I have to become better in virtually every aspect of my life. Not all at one time, not going to happen overnight, but my character traits, who I am as a spouse, who I am as a parent, who I am as a child, as a student, as a Jew, as a member of my community, professional group. So if a person's not in that type of modality, you really won't know what I'm talking about. If a person's like, well, look, you know, I'm better than the guy next door, and like, you know, I've never been indicted, so, you know, I'm pretty good to go, you know, we can afford to set the bar higher. We have to set the bar higher, okay? Because we're living in a world that's setting the bar lower and lower. You don't hear so much about people being great human beings. We hear about great quarterbacks, and you hear about great investors, and you hear about great politicians, or at least you used to. So the idea is that we're here to become great. That's our goal. And that's why we're here. We're to become more benevolent, more patient, more humble, and that's why we're here at Azalea Circle tonight. Very good. Very politically correct address. Great. Now, great. What we're going to talk about over here is specifically a little background on PC, political correctness, where it came from, where it's going, but basically three ideas that we're going to hit. One is the concept of the way we talk about things, the way things are debated, is completely changed and undergone a revolution. Now, it's not really the actual substance of what's being discussed or the merits of it, but how am I talking about it? That's one problem we're going to deal with, albeit briefly. The second thing is that the concept of truth, something being true. This is true. This is emes. So that word is, like, out of here. See you later. That word of emes and truth is very, very rare commodity in today's day and age, if at all. And the last thing is our ability to give, and more importantly, our ability to receive criticism. Because if we live in a world where you can't say anything wrong about anybody, you can't look at anything wrong, or so then we've lost a huge impediment to growing, which is the ability to hear that you could be better if you did X, Y, or Z. Okay, those are the main points we're going to hit. Great. PC. PC actually goes back to the middle of the 20th century. It's a term that came up in communist and socialist societies over here, but we all know it from the late 80s when it hit the campuses and things started to go bananas with multiculturalism and affirmative action, et cetera, et cetera. And it really started off kind of in a much more benign type of fashion. So you had a colored person, right? That became a black person. The terminology became an Afro-American, became African-American, right? Okay, so that was... I don't know if anybody felt, you know, on a personal front by that. Okay, that's the person feels more comfortable, or they're more, that's more genealogically correct. So, okay, gay goes on to hate. Right? Yeah, the Native Indian was a Native American. Okay, happened to make for a great Seinfeld episode. But other than that, though, so if a person wants to be a Native American, if they're bothered by the St. Johns, they're called the Redmen, they want to be called the Red Storm. Okay, I don't know how much it really bothered us. Fine. Then you had the whole business where a fireman became a firefighter, right? And the postman became the postal worker, correct? And then it started to really get out of hand when a manhole became a maintenance hole, right? And then at this point, we're saying, whoa, like, there's more going on here. Like, no one's offended. The manhole's, like, who's offended by that? You got way too much time in your hands if that's what you're bothered by, right? I mean, like, come on. Right, so at this point, we're beginning to say that there's more going on over here, and probably as Jews, we've all been on the receiving end of questions. Well, isn't it true? And you know, it's not a question. A person's not coming to ask. They're really just coming to make a political statement, and they're attaching a question mark at the end of that question. Right? Well, don't you feel? And how come women don't do this? Like, well, I'm happy to, you know, if you really want to know, here's my wife's number. Give her a call. I'm sure she'll tell you all about it, or I can do my best. But a lot of times, this person just has a little bit of an axe to grind. Right? I think we've all been in those situations. So some of my favorite headlines that I came up with while I was doing some research here was the fact that in the Charleston Gazette said that Seattle, this is a couple, is in just not so long, about a month ago, joined Minneapolis and Berkeley. They changed Columbus Day. Here it is. Columbus Day is now Indigenous People Day. Now, come on. Like, how many people out there are really offended by Columbus, right? So now, you know, the one thing that every kid knows, 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, like, forget about it. Like, that's like, you know, thought police, out of here, right? Fine. Then this one was great. You know, apparently the nursery rhyme Baba Black Sheep has now become Baba Rainbow Sheep. Again, one of these things where you get the sense that we're gradually slipping into George Orwell. We're gradually, you know, it's like 1984, Animal Farm. We're going off the deep end. And then, you know, my all-time favorite was the following, was that there was a recruiter, a business recruiter in the United Kingdom, and in his job advertisement, they asked for someone who was reliable and hardworking, and found out that it was offensive to people who are unreliable and lazy. I mean, come on already. Come on. You know, who are we kidding over here? So that's what we're dealing with. And the whole concept of politics and the way we discuss issues have become warped, right? This is, if you're familiar with George Orwell, right? Everyone's equal. Some are more equal than others. We get to a world where it's, you know, like you're in one of those museums with the weird, you know, mirrors, and things are not exactly what you see. There was a very interesting cartoon which had a guy strolling in his big 10-gallon hat and his revolver. He had just shot another cowboy, and it was the big cowboy who was alive and well was political correctness, and the cowboy who was shot and laid out was the First Amendment. And he said, there's no room in this world for the two of us. Right? So again, this is beginning to hit close to not necessarily Jewish values, but American values, our ability to be able to debate people. Dennis Prager, for those of you who know him, the radio commentary, wrote a very interesting article called Does the Left Value Truth? Now, we understand that truth, you know, before we kind of attack anybody, truth's not the only value that we have in society, right? If someone busts into your house and they, you know, find some type of criminal, you know, you have a counterfeit money machine, correct? So, well, they found it, so why don't we just present that to the jury? The answer is what? We have amendments, we have rights, we have constitutional rights, we value, right, but it's true, but you possessed it. Yeah, but we have another right called security, called freedom, liberty to be left alone by government, okay? So we say, we understand we live in a world where M is not always the coin of the realm, right? There's something called shalom. Right? There's something called tact. There's derech eretz. There's etiquette. There's other values besides emes per se. Correct? Anyone who's championing affirmative action, they weren't necessarily saying, well, you know, down with meritocracy. They had another value that they wanted to elevate, which is equality or whatever it happens to be. So there, it's done in the name of value. But he says the following. He says that the denial of what is so true is we've given a term for the denial of what is true, and that's called political correctness. Interesting way of looking at things. Meaning, again, it started at a point, well, I'll be offended if you refer to me by this term. And now we're basically using this as to now go on the offensive and say that anything you hold out is true and emes and eternal is going to be off limits. Correct? Now, there was a very interesting, and he goes on to show various different aspects of the way this plays itself out. Gender differences. There was a well-known professor in Harvard who was basically run out of town because he was saying that men and women develop their mental processes different. You know, the way men process math or science and women process English and history, these type of things. And I didn't study the research, but he had what to base it on. And that was it. Forget it. Like, what are you doing making differences between people? And that's not politically correct. And goodbye. See you later. And this is Harvard, right? There was an interesting story. I don't know if anyone saw it in Winsookie in Vermont. Anyone saw the story about the bacon? There was a sign. There was a sign that was hung outside in Vermont, right? About that they come in and grab a bacon burger or something at this particular restaurant, and someone, you know, twittered or said, like, I find that sign very offensive because I'm a vegan and a Muslim and I'm very anti-bacon. And it triggered off this whole discussion, and now this person's apologizing and like come on, like, you know, we're not pro-bacon either, but, you know, we're not making a federal case out of it, right? So that's what he's saying. He's saying in the brave new world, to Dennis Prager, truth doesn't have an objective existence. Everything, even truth, is relative. So sometimes we're talking with people, and you know they're not looking for emes. They're just looking for their particular. But let's call a spade a spade. If you don't want to say, well, there's something called truth, okay, at least we're on a level playing field. But you can't have it where we're saying, well, there is truth out there, but only if you look at it through my angles, only if you look at it through my window, my glasses. Anyway, that's the world that we tend to be gravitating towards. I know that Zajcik spoke recently about the ramifications and the whole controversy regarding the death of Klinghoffer. And again, It's not like some off, you know, fringe off Broadway. It's a metropolitan opera, right? So this is probably like the apex of culture and society, right? The Death of Klinghoffer is playing there, correct? Now, the director said the goal was to understand the hijackers and their motivations and to look for humanity in the terrorists. Like what's going on? This is the director of the Metropolitan Opera, right? This is an educated person. It's not like it's like a, you know, it's a election for, you know, Senate, and it could have gone either way. This is black and there's nothing more black and white than that evil. Correct? And nevertheless, we want to look for the humanity and paint it, and now we're going to charge people how much for a seat by the opera, and all of a sudden it's art. Right? All of a sudden it's art. And this is in our backyard. This is in our backyard. Now, for any of you who follow what happened with CNN and the way they covered the most recent tragedy, unbelievable. It's my wife, like, she kept asking me again, and so for those of you who CNN runs a ticker, it says 4 Israelis and 2 Palestinians dead in Jerusalem. Now, the fact that 2 were the actual terrorist murderers, right, that was, right, then of course the first time they ran the news was that there was an attack at a mosque in Jerusalem.
Really?
The first, you see a picture, attack in Jerusalem mosque. So,
Eric Sheva said, Israeli police killed 2 Palestinians.
Oh, Israeli police killed 2 Palestinians. Now, there's nothing. Now, again, if this would take place in Ferguson, you know, Missouri, like, just, Metzias, just reporting. Just, people are reporters. They have responsibility to report accuracy. This is CNN. This is not like some blogger who's sitting in the middle of Wyoming with some plot to, like, get rid of the Jews. This is CNN. So, anyway, there's this gentleman. Excuse me, by the name of Yosef Dagan, and he's the head of media relations in Samaria. So he files a complaint, and he said, there's no reality where journalists report a terror attack in this style. There is good and there is bad, and there are killers and there are victims. There's good and there's bad, and there's killers and there's victims. Right? Now, I don't know how far back we have to go. 20 years ago? We wouldn't be discussing things like this, right? And now this is from Operation Protective Edge, right? The Washington Post reports from the leader, one of the spokesmen of Hamas, we have won. We've done what no one else did. We defeated the Israelis. Like, what are they talking about, right? What game are they watching, right? Or you love the headline, you know, the ceasefire started with 50 missiles being launched on Israel. Like, see, hello, did that translator guy, like, did he miss work today? Cease fire, stop firing, right? And the world goes on. No one's missed a beat. We're not even surprised about it anymore, right? People openly speaking, you know, what a victory. We shut down Ben Gurion Airport. Great. Like, what world are we living in? And that's a situation where Emmis is out the window. There's an interesting cartoon I saw. I was researching. There's a boy. He's in elementary school, and he writes on the board, you know, 2 + 2 = 5. And the teacher's looking at it like he didn't do a very good job. He said, "Do you want the answer or the politically correct answer?" Like, there's something else out there. Right? 2 + 2 = 5. But okay, but you got to look at it from my angle. You got to see it my way. And who says you're right? So that's the now. One of the other phenomenon is that spirituality is completely off the map. I was wondering, hey, maybe Jason, you know, they used to have in the courts in Brooklyn. Most courtrooms would say, "In God we trust."
Yeah.
So I don't know how recent it is, but you won't find them there anymore. Now they're quoting Burke, and they have other and Mill and other, you know, right. Then there was a court case recently. They tried to take "In God We Trust" off the dollar bill,
yeah,
right, and lost. So, like, come on. You know what I'm saying? I'm sure they're not offended by you. They'd much rather have a grant. No matter how, you know, PC they are, they'd much rather have a grant in their pocket than a Franklin. Right? At that point, they don't mind. You know, they'd rather have the 50 than the 20. But in the meantime, God we trust? What's going on? So I was looking back. You should catch on who said this. He says, "Tonight, I ask for your prayers for all those who grieve. And I pray we'll be comforted by a power greater than any of us spoken through the ages." And you know who said this? Okay. "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. This is a day when all Americans from every walk of life unite in our resolve for justice and peace. America has stood down enemies before, and we'll do this time. Anyone got it? None of us will ever forget this day. We go forward to defend freedom and all that is good and just in our world. Thank you, good night, and God bless America. George Bush, that's right. That's right. George Bush said it right after the night of September 11th, right? Night of September 11th, so that was 2001. Now, I don't know if that speech is being made today, irrespective of Obama. But when he said, God bless America, that's true. That's a value that we as human beings need and want and should respect in our lives. And now the pendulum has swung so far the other way that now I want to have something which the country is based upon, with freedom of religion and separation of church and state, and I'm not going there, but just in terms of a value. So this is something which is important for me to have as part of my radar screen, as part of my arsenal in being a human being. And it's under attack. And that's the world we live in. Fine. Odd con up until here was our lesson in political correctness. Now, number one, how does it affect what we're doing in this world as Jews? How does this undermine, what do we got to be on the lookout for? How can we see this, where it's coming from, and diffuse it? One is the following, is that there's so much talk going on. You know, every radio station, every sport, talk, everyone's talking, politics, talking, military, just talking. Just tons of talking heads. That's it. I don't know if anything's getting done. I don't know if people are getting to the merits. I don't know if there's true debates that are taking place on things. It's talk. So Rav Samson Flora Hirsch, beautiful commentary on Pirkei Avos. So we know a Mishnah. Mishnah in Pirkei Avos is what? It says, spent his whole life among sages, and the best thing he found for his was, what was the best thing? Silence. Okay? One of the authors of the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Now, he grew up among sages. He didn't grow up reading the New York Post. He grew up among sages, and I'm sure he had a lot of chachma, a lot of things to give over. But for him, he said that the best thing was silence. Okay? And we would have said, how would we have said pshat? How would we have understood that Mishnah? We would have said the following. We said, because, probably would have said one of two ways. A lot of times we open our big mouth, and we wish we could have kept quiet. So he learned that more often than not, if I keep quiet, I'm going to stay out of trouble. That's probably what we would learn, straightforward. Or we would have said, because if I listen and I'm quiet, I'll stand to learn more from the other guy than if I start telling him my opinion. That's probably what we would have learned one of those two ways. Listen to a beautiful insight from Samson Hirsch. He says, one of the worst consequences of profuse talk is when you've spoken long and a lot and zealously on behalf of a cause, you're going to persuade yourself that that alone is action. I spoke about it so passionately, so I must have done something about it. So then, when your voice is going to come and say, you know, you really haven't exerted yourself, you haven't done anything for the thing, you say, no. Don't you remember how much I spoke about it? I spoke about it with such enthusiasm and such brilliance, and I advocated for it. So then I pat myself on the back. I'm good to go. That's what I spoke about it. I'm done. I feel my obligation over here. We as Jews were people of action, right? Avraham Avinu didn't become Avraham Avinu by just talking a good game, right? At 99 years old, the hottest day the world has seen in who knows how many years, 3 days after his bris, he's running out to get guests, right? If he'd be sitting there, you know, talking about how good kindness is, he wouldn't have made it. He wouldn't have been Avraham Avinu, right? So we have to be careful. We hear people talking. What is going on? At the end of the day, what is going on? What is being said? Is anything being said? There's a related concept to this. Is a story that's told over in the Gemara. It says the following: that came time to bury Jacob, time to bury Yaakov, and there was a whole debate, a whole discussion with his sons, all the various different tribes, the Jewish people, and it was taking a while. It was taking an extended period of time. And Hushim ben Don, so he had, right, Don was one of the sons of Yaakov, and Hushim was a son of his. So he peeked over one of his brothers, uncle, says, I said, what's taking so long? He said, you know, Uncle Esav showed up, and he said that really Maris Machpelah, the cave of Machpelah, really doesn't belong to Yaakov, it really belongs to Esav. And he says, yeah, so what? He says, so we had to send Naftali. Naftali, you know, he has to go get this, the document, and he has to prove it, and he has to make a whole case. He said, what are you talking about? Hushimion gets up, takes out his sword, and lops off Esav's head. End of story. And the question is asked by Rechaim Shulevitz. He says the following. He said, why was a Hushim ben Don? Of all the, there were a lot of people who were there. They obviously were all pro Yaakov. Like, what motivated him more than anybody else? So he points out, which the Gemara points out, that Hushim ben Don was deaf. He was deaf. Hard of hearing. So what? He said because everyone else was there was kind of like lured into this. Oh, Esav is saying no. Maybe the plot was sold, and he's got a claim, and maybe he's got a good point, and let's see about that, and let's go get the document. So everyone's kind of slowly now engaging this whole give and take with, well, maybe it's legitimate. Maybe Uncle Esav has a point. Whereas Hushim ben Don, he heard the whole thing. When he heard it, he didn't hear it, it was gradually playing itself out, but he tapped his uncle on the shoulder and said, what's going on? And he heard it in one fell swoop. Esav wants to take Yaakov's plot. Goodbye. See you later. There's nothing to talk about. It's crazy. This is crazy. This is the death of King Klinghoffer. This is us not being sucked into a world where, oh, let's have a debate about this. Like, maybe let's understand the humanity of the terrorists. Like, what in the world's going on? How do we get there? The answer is we didn't really get there overnight. This has been a current that's been playing itself out for several decades now. Right? And just like when you're on the beach and you start getting... So we have to be mindful of that. And whenever we get in discussions with things that we really, really know are not emes, and we start getting things which are really rife with political correctness, and as soon as we step in for what we know is true and timeless and emes, we know we're going to have ourselves in hot water. So we have to be mindful of not queuing up the dialogue from someone else's perspective. Right? You have been given seichel. You've been given a Torah. You've been given emes. Those are glasses to look at life through. Okay? We don't have to buy hook, line, and sinker into every paper, every commentary. We don't have to do that. We don't have to go there. Great. Now, just a brief reminder, or for those of you who don't know me, I grew up with a pretty straightforward, conservative Jewish education in Long Island. And when I got to law school, I said, no, this is really crazy. I said, I'm going to law school now. So it's 12 years of high school, and now 4 years of college, 3 years of law school, 17 years of education, and like I got a third grade Jewish education. I wasn't interested in becoming religious. I mean, that was religious. That was like, you know, crazy. But in the meantime, like, let me be at least educated, somewhat educated. So one of the things that was most profound events that happened to me, really like a pendulum swing event, was that after I took the bar, I went to Israel. And was involved in a program which was part studying and part traveling the country. And we started learning a Gemara called Makos. Any of you familiar with the Gemara? There's a Gemara called Makos. Okay, very interesting Gemara, very interesting piece of Talmud. And we went up for Shabbos, Friday, Shabbos, Sunday, to Sfas. Fine. So Friday afternoon, I was sitting in this shul, beautiful shul. If anybody's ever been to Sfas, the air there is something else, and the light is something else. And so a friend of mine says, you know, do you want to review the Gemara? So I said, okay. So he looks on the shelf, and he pulls a Makos off the shelf, right? And he and I are now looking at this text from this Gemara, and I don't know how many years that Gemara has been there. 50 years, 60 years. I don't know how that shul's been there. 100 years, 200 years, 300 years. And it started to dawn on me that I am part of something which is timeless. And there's a Makos in every single shul. And there's one in Paris, and there's one in Sydney, and there's one in Melbourne, and there's one in Moscow. I said, this is unbelievable. I said, I am part of something which is eternal. I could run into my great, 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 great grandfather in the street and have something to talk to him about. And it wouldn't be the Knicks, and it wouldn't be the weather, it wouldn't be Obama. It'd be this Gemara in Makos. Anyone been to the Diaspora Museum in Israel? Anyone been there? Yes, no, maybe? Very, very interesting museum. You go there, it shows you the chuppah that they had in 13th century Venice and the bris they had in 15th century Barcelona. And you're all beginning to say, like, wait a second, I know that. I know that. I know that chauffeur. And you begin to say, like, wow, this is part of something which is eternal, right? Spans centuries, spans geography. That's what I'm a part of. I moved to yeshiva, and first day I came back, I said to my wife, I said, I may be in a little over my head over here. I went to, upper-level yeshiva, local. I said, I may be in over my head. She says, well, what are you talking about? I said, well, these guys were going back and forth on the Gemara left and right and this way. She said, yeah, so, you could do that too. I said, but these guys were so animated. He got up, he leaped across the table. He said, what about the Rif? Now, the Rif lived in North Africa in the 11th century. And this 19-year-old kid is flying over the table because he thinks he knows what the Rif had to say. 11th century Africa? And a 20-year-old boy? Well, how did that happen? How did that happen? A person realizes that they're part of something which is endless. Right? Now, we're the torchbearers of that. Right? The reason we're here is because somebody inspired us from a previous generation. Correct? The reason Rabbi Zaitchik is here, we were speaking before, from his Rebbe and his Rebbe's Rebbe, and we'll trace it all the way back. There's a program that's been very successful in Kirov and outreach called the Maimonides program. Ever heard of the Maimonides program? They do it on campuses and everything else like this, yeah? So at the end of it, when you graduate the Maimonides program, they give you a sheet. They give you a sheet, and it says Moshe. And it says Yeshua, and it gives you the whole chain, and it gives you the Rambam, and it gives you Rabbi Kiva Eger, and it goes through the whole slew of things, and it gives you the Chavetz Chaim and Moshe Feinstein, and there's two spaces at the bottom of the sheet. And the teacher says, I want you to put your name on the bottom line, and I want you to put my name one line above it. Because you're part of a chain. You're part of a Masorah. You're part of something called Emes. So now what does that mean? So now someone comes to me and says, well, look, I'd like to redefine what marriage means. I'd like to say that these two fellows can be husband and husband. I don't know what they call themselves, right? Whatever, right? So now the next person's coming with this, that, well, how do you feel about same-gender marriage, right? So now, again, this we're walking into a total, you can't win with this discussion at all, right? You're much better off just saying, like, here's a piece of kugel. You get much farther than the kugel, right? You get much farther than the kugel. But in the meantime, so the answer is that the Torah has defined something called marriage. Correct? Now, I can't marry a potato. I might like to. Why not? Maybe I'll marry a duck. Maybe a three-year-old. Like, at what point are we? And the answer is that the Torah defines something called marriage. And if I've accomplished that, then I've accomplished marriage. And if I haven't, then I haven't. Give me an example. Moshe. Everyone agrees. Great Jew. Fabulous Jew, right? Moshe. All-star. And he's got a sister. His sister's name is Miriam. Now, that would be, let's breed super Jews, right? We'll put together Moshe and Miriam. Be a great couple. They grew up in the same house. Right? So what do we think of that? That's a nice idea. And Moshe is now, we're now at the wedding of Moshe and Miriam. Is that happening? No, that's not happening. That's not happening. And even if they'll go down to the chuppah, and he'll give her the ring, harayat mekudeshes li, and then 5 minutes later, another person comes up and gives a ring to Miriam, so Miriam's married to the second guy, because the first marriage, quote-unquote, was nothing. It wasn't real. It did not, there's a halachic definition of accomplished marriage, and if it's accomplished marriage, it hasn't, it's something else. You want to call whatever you want, you call it friendship, dedication, whatever it happens to be, but the world of halacha, the world of Torah, has definitions, and that's all that's what we live with. There's a one of the most people know the name of Moshe Feinstein. He was the bottom line in halachic decisions the last 20, 30 years. So the shaila came to him. A question came to him about Siamese twins. They're Siamese twins, and they had one brother at half a heart and one brother at a full heart. Moshe stayed at home for 10 days until he came up with a psak, until he decided, what's the guy going to do with a half a heart, and, this one's, what kind of life is that, and you're not going to, No, not a political decision, not a hospital decision. The greatest Jewish mind knew everything backwards and forwards. It took 10 days. Now, 10 days of Moshe's time was 10 days of Klal Yisrael's time. It took 10 days to figure out, is this murder or am I saving someone's life? There's a very interesting discussion about why that was, and we could speak about it some other time. But when a person looks at things through halacha, we have one of our Friday night Shabbos table customs is we ask really interesting halacha questions, and the guests get into it, and the kids get into it. So there was a guy, and he was having a hard time getting a job. You know, the economy was tough. He said, I know, I got a great idea. There's a lot of people out there with a lot of angst. So I'm going to hire myself out as a human punching bag. Okay? So he's going to go out in the street, and for $5, you can hit him for 30 seconds. That's it? It's a good idea, right? And the guy was making money. The guy was doing great. But then he said, you know, wait a second. Like, you know, maybe it's you can't, one Jew can't hit another Jew, and maybe I can't put my life in danger. And well, lo and behold, the Shaila goes up to one of the biggest halachic deciders in the world about whether or not it's forbidden or not forbidden for this person to do this, right? And if we just say, hey, well, you know, gay guys went to hate, and you're not hurting anybody, and you know, I'm okay, you're okay. But we live in a world of emes. We live in a world of truth, and that truth is defined by Shulchan Aruch. Great. Now, the what it means to live with emes, what it means to live with truth, is that that's the crucible, that's the lens I have to hold my life up to, my business dealings. Heard an interesting story this past Shabbos. Before Sukkot, people get their lulav and their esrog, and many people have a practice. They bring it to the rabbi first to have it check it out. Is it kosher? Does it look good? Not good. Did I get my money's worth? So there was a certain expert in Jerusalem. His name was Rabbi Pick. And there's long lines outside his office to see, check it. So at one point he gets up and he says, guys, I never saw an esrog that wasn't good. He says, and I never saw a dollar that was. Whew, I was a zinger. Meaning that we're all busy, you know, right? Well, what's my matzahs look like? But how my business? I'm running my business emes. I'm running a business with truthful, and every dollar is an honest dollar, and every, right? Am I approaching concepts of marriage? Am I approaching concepts of raising children, education, right? All these things are filtered through a prism of emes. There's a story in the Gemara, amazing story. There was a man, and he had a certain agricultural, he had a farm. So as many of you know, it's Shemitah, it's the seventh year in Israel, and they're not working the ground. So he had a certain agricultural activity that his workers was involved in. They were doing some type of irrigation or something, and he had a question. Maybe it's not allowed. Maybe it's prohibited. And if it is prohibited, then maybe I got to find an alternative way to do this. I got to save my crops. So he goes all the way down from his moshav or his kibbutz, and he goes all the way down to Jerusalem to ask one of the greatest sages of the day. And he asks, he says, I have two questions to ask you. He says, is what they're doing allowed? And he said, no. And the guy turned around and he walked all the way back to his kibbutz to stop the practice right away. And then a day later he came back and he said, what about the second question? He said, the second question was, well, what do I do? What do I do to do it in an effective way that's consistent with Jewish law? He said, well, why didn't you just ask me on the spot? You were right here. You were like, you just asked me. He said, well, as soon as I heard that it wasn't right, I had to go back as soon as I could. Because it wasn't emes. As soon as I heard that that practice was not acceptable, I take care of that straight away. That's a person who's living with emes. Now, so far so good? Questions, comments, rebuttal? Coffee break. Okay. Very important. And this is something which is major under assault in the world of political correctness, is taking responsibility for myself. Okay? Now, we live in a world that everyone's a victim. Everyone's, oh, look at the society you grew up in, and you grew up too poor, and you grew up too wealthy, and you didn't have an education, you had too much education, and your parents weren't there, your parents gave you too much attention. Everybody's got an excuse. Everybody's got an excuse. Funny, I used to read these transcripts of people trying to get a jury duty. So say, Your Honor, you know, I can't be there. I have a very important conference in Bermuda. We have to cancel that. Well, it's also, I also, all these excuses, they're rolling out. The judge is like, get out of here. Get out of the jury. So we have to be aware of the fact that nobody is expected, I shouldn't say nobody, the bar of what's expected of people keeps getting lower and lower. There is a sign, I kid you not, in the city court in Yonkers. Okay, forget about a suit, a tie. It says, pants must be worn at the waist. Now, okay, so I'm not offended by the metal detector and everything else. Like, fine, pant, like, what? It's a court of law. What's going on over here? Right? Am I right?
You're right.
It's unbelievable. So we all have someone else to blame, right? The person's, you know, lungs fell out and he's got to sue, you know, Camel. Why? Well, I smoked a pack a day, you know, for 10 years. What do you want from me, right? And the coffee's too hot and you got to sue someone else, right? That case never came to me or you. But in the meantime, right, everything's, I'm not responsible. Me? I have a sharp temper. I have a sharp temper. I have an ugly temper. Anger is something which is not consistent with becoming a perfect human being. Correct? I run a tight ship. My marriage, what I say goes. Let me ask your wife. she may have a different opinion on things, right? Oh, this I run my house with an iron fist. My kids always listen. Yeah, that's why they're so depressed. That's why they never talk to you, right? So we have to be aware of the fact that if we don't take an honest look at how we do things, we have 100 reasons to pat ourselves on the back and say we're doing just fine. Got it? Now, this is, once we hit cruise control in any aspect of our life, I'll give you an example, Shabbos, davening, holidays, that's just the way I do it. I don't know, that's just the way I do it. And how long are you doing that? I don't know, as long as I can remember, that's what we do. I don't know, that's the same. I wonder if I daven any better now than I did 10 years ago. I wonder if my Shabbos is the same as it was 5 years ago. Like, it's just on cruise control. My marriage on cruise control, my chinuch, my education, my kids, it's just, I just hit my comfort zone, and that's it. And from time to time, I'll be inspired by, you know, I gotta be different, and I'll hear a lecture, or whatever. But it's gonna fade, unless I'm serious about taking responsibility for myself. There's a very interesting sefer called Shari Oyer. It's written by Avigdor Miller, actually written posthumously after him, but very powerful idea. So he's talking about tshuva, improving ourselves, and he talks about cheshbon nefesh. Cheshbon nefesh is a self-accounting. You know, you get in the car nowadays, and tells you that you have, you know, the left tire is a little bit low. It gives you a whole diagnostic. So he's saying that we have to do a diagnostic, a self-diagnostic, global, not just Judaism, life. Am I living healthy? What does my marriage look like? What's my eating look like? What's my business look like? Whole, total scope. And he says, now that's not such a bad idea. Anybody who's serious about running a business is going to bring in someone to take a look at the business and assess it. I'm sure U.S. Airways, right, JetBlue, they bring in someone probably every month to say, well, you know, don't fly to Columbus, fly out of St. Louis, and don't serve peanuts, right? I'm sure, right? Anybody who's serious about this. I know someone, he pays someone big money, and he comes into their office and follows him and his partner around and gives them and then gives them constructive credit. He pays big bucks for it. Because why? He's serious about improving. Right? People with a golf swing, they go in the video, and they have all these tools and gadgets. And they want to get better. So he says the following, Yesoid shecheshbon nefesh, the foundation of a proper self-reckoning, hu hargashas achrayas, sheyesh loy al atzma, that I have responsibility for myself. But if I don't take, let me say one more time, the foundation of cheshbon nefesh, of making a true reckoning, is that I am responsible for myself. I have to take responsibility for myself. Right? Now, a lot of times we want to take responsibility for more than ourselves. Maybe we want to take responsibility for our community. Maybe we want to take responsibility, right? That was a famous story about you want to change the world. At the end of the day, you realize you can only change himself. So we're all very busy trying to change other people. And we're living in a world that's saying, don't bother changing yourself. You're great the way you are. So, like, where's the incentive? What's motivating me over here? So that's something which is very, very dangerous and very something that really undermine a whole person's direction in life. There was a man, when the vanity plates started coming out in the 70s, these type of things, right? So he has a great idea. He moved down to Baltimore. I told you the story about the vanity plates? Okay, good. So he has a great idea. He gets a license plate, Torah 613. And he's going to drive around, and he's going to be a big knocker in town, and he's going to bring lots of Jews back to the fold with his Torah 613 license plate. So it's Friday afternoon, and he's got to go to the bakery, and it's a snowy afternoon, and he's just got to run in, and there's no spots, so he double parks, runs in, comes out, there's a note on the window with a license plate to Torah 613, you should really know better. Oh. Oosh. You know, like really just took the whole wind out of his sails. Then about 3 weeks later, he's running late to Mincha, and he's behind this woman, and she's, you know, going 10 miles an hour, and what, he passes her, and then it, as always happens, he gets stuck at the same light, right? And you know what's happening. She rolls down the window, and then he rolls down the window. He knows what's coming. You know, Rabbi, with a license plate Torah 613, you should really know better. Right? And then it happened a third time, and he got a ticket for something. He comes home. He tells his wife. He says, that's it. I had this. I need ABC 123. I just need an anonymous license plate. None of this Torah 613. It's too much pressure. So she says, you know, Rabbi, I'm very proud of you. Instead of changing your midos, you'll change your license plate. Right? Instead of saying, well, look, I'm a Yid, I'm a Jew, I'm going to live up to basic traffic laws and Derech Eretz. No. Right? This idea that I am responsible for myself. You know, one thing that always bothered me with Rosh Hashanah. How are we doing time-wise here, everybody? 9:56, okay. One thing that always bothered me with Rosh Hashanah is it's the judgment day, right? We're being judged. So why is it the first day of the new year? Anybody ever bothered this question? Imagine you show up the first day of eighth grade, first day of law school. Here's your final exam. What are you talking about? I didn't learn anything yet. I didn't start. It should be, if you tell me it'd be the 30th day of the previous month of Elul. Okay, so you grade me on the whole previous year. What am I being graded on the first day of the year? Anyone ever bothered by this question? I was bothered by this question every year. But I think an answer is like this. On Rosh Hashanah, we're given a pen. And all the books are open. There's a book of life, and there's a book of Misa, death, and there's a book of the Tzaddikim, the righteous people, and the book of the Rishonim, the evil people, and probably a lot of books in between. And God says, you know what? Here. Put your name in one of these books. The pen is in your hands. Now, what book am I signing up for? Am I signing up for status quo? I'm doing A-OK. I'm better than the guy next door. I'm signing up for, this year I'm going to be a little bit better. I'm signing up for, I'm going to be a tzaddik. I am being judged on what book am I putting myself in. What am I demanding of myself? Right? When I'm done demanding things from other people, what am I demanding for myself? I'm putting myself in the book of people who don't gossip. I'm putting myself in the people who judge people favorably. I'm putting myself in the book of people who keep Shabbos, who daven, who say Tehillim for the people who are sick in Jerusalem and in Israel. Like, what book am I putting myself in? And if it's the same book I was in last year, and the year before, and the year before, and the year before, chances are I can do better. Chances are we can do better. And that's why, you know, the guy, he goes to shul, he comes back, he says to his wife, he says, you know, I don't know. I don't get it. They don't have another book besides the whale. Every time I'm in shul, they tell me about the whale. He goes once a year. He goes on Yom Kippur. So every time he comes back, they talk about the whale again. Don't they have any other stories? Like, come on. So the question's a very, you know, anybody who's familiar with the prophets, with Navi, knows everybody spoke about improve, do better, right? Everybody, that's what made the prophets. Right, so mix it up one year. Enough with Yonah. We've done that enough. Let's do Yecheskel. Let's get wild. You know, so why Yonah? Why Yonah? So I heard a beautiful idea. Because Yonah pointed the finger at himself. Right, when the seas got stormy, and everyone was pointing the finger, Yonah said, "Mea culpa, this is my fault." He took a level of, we call it achrayas, a level of responsibility that is unusual. The person to say, I made a mistake. And mean it. And not like you're trying to, you know, plea bargain. Like, honestly, and I want to be better, right? A person would say that to a spouse, to an employee, someone that has feelings they rub the wrong way, whatever happened. I'm sorry. I want to do better. It's my fault. That's powerful. The minute a person comes, it's my fault, there's hope that I will grow. It doesn't be my fault like I'm crushed. I'm aware that I can do better. Right? Every person who knows anything about educating kids, you don't tell the kid you're stupid. Right? You tell the kid you think you can do better. Right? Great. Now, by the way, this concept of self-perfection and growth is not very much in vogue. I remember I was in one of the first jobs I had at a law school was for a big law firm in the city. And the last Meyer of Manhattan then was 10:15. That was my question. I walked in the morning, would I make the last Meyer of Manhattan? That was my question. A lot of hours, a lot of stress. So I was getting stressed out also. So someone told me you have to learn how to breathe. Did I tell you something? You have to learn how to breathe. I thought I was breathing just fine for the first 25 years, but apparently not. You got to breathe into your belly, and you got to breathe out your ears. It's a whole thing. So, of course, some Jewish guy, Bernard something or other, is making a fortune teaching people how to breathe, right? So I go to Walden Books or Barnes & Noble, and I say, do you have, you know, how to breathe? So the guy says, oh, yeah, sure, Bernard. Everyone's got that book, right? He says, it's over in the self-help section. I said, oh, not there. I don't want to go to the self-help section. You know, anywhere else was cool. Anywhere else, science fiction was cool, right? And you know, do-it-yourself home improvements. But the self-help section was like, no, you don't want to go there. Those are all those people like trying to quit smoking for like the 92nd time, right? It's not in vogue. It's not in vogue. But we have to see that that's our responsibility to ourselves. We have to deliver ourselves to Hashem. We have to deliver ourselves to us. There's potential that's there that we have to tap into. Chofetz Chaim says the following. He says in the discussion of Shmiras Lashon, when you can speak positively, when you can speak negatively about people, one of the obviously situations that comes up is when you need to tell someone that they've done something wrong. Correct? You just see someone has used profanity and you want to explain to your child that that's not appropriate. You see someone who came home and said, you know, that rabbi's speech was really lousy again. It's appropriate to tell people that's incorrect. Not an appropriate way to speak. Fine. So he says the following. He says, to abstain from speaking up and offering another guidance is depriving someone of the most valuable tool for personal growth. Okay? Now again, everyone has to have a brain in their head and don't just start, criticizing everyone you meet, you have to say. But if we want to deliver ourselves, we have to be comfortable receiving constructive criticism. That doesn't have to be from everybody, but we should have that person in our life who is our mentor. Now, we could have 10 mentors. You'd have a professional mentor, you have a mentor in a marriage, you have a mentor for kids, whatever it happens to be, right? But one of the 48 ways of acquiring Torah is oyhev esatechacha, person who loves rebuke. Now, I don't know how many people in the world you love rebuke. Right? That's one of the things that... But Sev Zev Sansa for Hirsch, if you love Toichacha, you won't be angry with someone who points out an error or fault, but you'll thank him with all your heart and view him as your greatest benefactor. Right? A person played under, Bill Parcells, or, coach was a real taskmaster. They probably love him. Why? Because he brought me to some place that I would not have gotten on my own. And probably under a softy, I wouldn't have got there either. Right? So, but nowadays, in the political correct world, this is completely out the window. Who are you to tell me what's right? Who are you to tell me what to do? Right? And the police officer is the one who's got to explain why he gave the guy a dirty look and why he pulled the person over. Right? And the teacher's got to be the one to explain why they disciplined the kid. And the parents also. Because leave me alone. Who says you're right? One of the signs that the Gemara says will be towards the end of days, the world is coming to its perfection. It says that chutzpah will run rampant. Chutzpah will run rampant. I think we've all probably seen that in areas of... like, where's basic decorum? Where's basic respect for elders? Where's all these things? And everything is a joke. Right? White House of joke. Things which, whether we agree with them or not, they're symbols of stability, they're symbols of respect, honor. We're all these things. They're going out the window more and more week in and week out. There's a famous story in the Gemara, you're probably familiar with it, that Chana didn't have any children, so she would daven. She davened very quietly, right? So she went to see Eli, went to see the leader of the Jewish people, and he accused her of being drunk. Now, if that would happen today, I mean, that's one rabbi to be out of a job. Right? But she didn't see it that way. She understood. Okay, this particular situation you may have misassessed, but you are who you are. You're the Goral, and I am the Talmidah who's coming to learn from you. Okay. We're going to wrap up. Any questions, comments, or rebuttals so far? Okay? Okay, I want to say the following. We have a tremendous responsibility, and I want to illustrate it with a story. The halacha is the following, is that we know every Saturday night, part of Havdalah is a candle, correct? So we strike a match, candle. On Yom Kippur, at the end of Yom Kippur, we also, what's that? Yeah, please explain. Okay, good. That's right. The Havdalah we make after Yom Kippur is from a pre-existing flame. A flame that some people have either a Yahrzeit candle or a Gesund light. They have different, a candle, 24-hour candle that they light from a pre-existing flame. A flame that was at rest for all of Yom Kippur. So one year I was doing this, and our candle had gone out. The candle had gone out 8 hours into Yom Kippur, 10 hours into Yom Kippur. Bottom line, at the end of Yom Kippur, we didn't have a candle. So what did I do? I went next door to my neighbors. I went to the Colemans. And I felt like Paul Revere. I brought over one of these lanterns. I had to get a candle, right? I had to get a candle from their house to my house. So I had one of these kind of Paul Revere lanterns. And I came over with a candle, and now I'm bringing it back home. And that's exactly what life is all about. We have to get our candle, that light of Emes, that goes all the way back to the Rif in North Africa, and all the way back way before him to Sinai. That's our candle. And we have to get it, I would say to the end of days, but I'll settle for the next generation. Everybody's here tonight, and every Jew, whether they know it or not, is a torchbearer of Emes, of truth. And those winds that have always blown are blowing stronger than they've probably ever been. Because Emes is a very hard sell. A very hard sell in today's world. It's not like, well, they're his version of Emes, it's my version. Emes itself is under assault. So it's a very tall order. It's a very, very tall order. Everything, the most basic things, intermarriage, these the most basic things. I remember the most very first experiences I had when I was becoming observant, that it was during Yizkor. So everyone whose parents are still alive are filing out. And the rabbi said, you know, all the people who are not participating in Yizkor, it's not like a halftime. You spend a minute or two thanking Hashem for your parents. And then he went further. He said, if your parents are not religious and all they ever told you was marry someone Jewish, you have no idea how much you owe them. Again, because nothing is for granted. And then they list the miracles, the 10 miracles that took place in the base of Migdash, in the Holy Temple. One of them is what? The fire, that pillar of smoke that came from the base of Migdash, was never squelched, never went out, never billowed. That's our obligation. We're in this world. There's a tremendous responsibility to realize, especially in light of events that took place this week, and the protective edge, and the whole way things are playing themselves out, the world is not where it was 50 years ago. It's not even where it was 5 years ago. And these things which are unheard of, issues of marriage, this the thing with Klinghoffer, the whole rhetoric of it all is so loosed from reality and so loosed from Emes. And that's our obligation. A person may not be in a position to affect the world, most of us are not, but high tide rises all boats in the harbor. A person makes little impact in his life or her life, or in their family, and they say, you know what, I'm not opting for just a life of pleasure and a life of I'll skate through and I'm okay, you're okay. I'm opting for a life of purposefulness. And it's not necessarily an easy road, but it's so fulfilling. And that's why the Chassam Sofer writes, close with this, he says that when a person becomes 13, becomes bar mitzvah, this is the very first thing you teach him. Mitzvah Rishoina, the very first mitzvah, Shemekayim Hanar, that a young boy fulfills, Miyad, right away, Beknisa Shnas Yud Dalet, as soon as he hits age 14, meaning 13 years, and Husas V'Sameach, that he should rejoice and be happy, Shezoiche L'Kabel all mitzvahs, that he merited to Mekabel the all, a yoke of mitzvahs, the simcha he mitzvahs asei deraisa, and that joyfulness is a mitzvah. It's a Torahic mitzvah to serve Hashem b'simcha with joy, b'tuv levav meroyev koil, with a full heart and with the abundance of everything that Hashem's given him. So mietz Hashem, it is my sincere wish that Jeb continue to grow, and that we all continue to grow, and that if we all pursue emes in our own lives, then mietz Hashem will be together with the Shana Habo of Yerushalayim.
Any questions? Any questions for Rabbi Vitter at this time? I was just wondering myself, you know, Rabbi Vitter was talking about how difficult it is to take a position based on truth. We live in a world that doesn't even think there's such a thing as objective truth. I was just wondering, how does Rabbi Vitter operate in the courtroom when he's trying to defend a particular point of view?
Because he's a zealous advocate for his client, and he took an oath to do so. And when you're a lawyer, that concept that you were talking about, it's hard for people to understand that, but a doctor can understand because they take a certain oath too. When you're a lawyer, you represent your client zealously within the bounds of the ethics, but you take your client's point of view and you go with it. And that, and unless there's something in that point of view that is so unethical and so like far afield, that's your job.
So does an attorney, before he takes a client, have a responsibility to decide whether the position of his client is based on truth?
There's always, listen, if you're talking about like a contract, right, and you say, well, in the writing it's X, and I say, well, in prior writing it's Y, well,
yes.
We both have two different truths.
Yes.
There is objective truth called emes, and there's subjective truth called two different contracts, or who caused the accident, or was this a risk of the procedure, or was this a deviation of, I mean, there truth,
yes,
Torah truth, and then there's human beings who have differences of opinions.
Michelle.
What struck me, I'm sorry I missed it here at the end, but we live in a world where belief is fact, just it's all topsy-turvy. And if you look at the death of Klinghoffer, the title tells you it's not, it should be the murder of Klinghoffer.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
So it tells you right away what it is.
Very good.
And we don't know how much money was given to produce that.
Right.
I've heard it was a lot more than normal.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is a...
Yeah, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Michelle.
Michelle. So make a very interesting point, just how, you know, things are often quite subtle. You know, and the more a person, you know, attunes their palate to these things, there was a world-famous violinist. So they asked him, they said, what happens if you don't practice? So he says, well, if I don't practice for 3 days, he says, the audience will know. He says, if I don't practice for 2 days, he says, my violin will know. He says, if I don't practice 1 day, he says, I'll know. So that it's the type of thing where the more a person sharpens their acumen and their radar for emes, they'll begin to get this. These things will resonate. These things will resonate. And you'll get a sense of, is a person calling a spade, or we're really not calling a spade because we have some other agenda to... That's a very fair point you're making. Can you see the question? No?
Any other thoughts? I want to thank Rabbi Vitter. phenomenal. So when I introduced Rabbi Vitus tonight, I pointed out that we had him speak once in the past, twice in the past, and I said, we're going to do it again tonight. We're so happy. Should we go for four?
Very good.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
My great pleasure.
And we want to, of course, thank Larry and Ann for their wonderful hospitality, opening up their home. And Larry and Ann would like to invite everybody to partake in the wonderful refreshments that they've prepared, and I hope you all have a safe drive home. We'll see you soon. God will.
Okay.
You guys do.
Good.